I'm Robert Newman. I'm the Dean of the College of Humanities and the Associate Vice President for Interdisciplinary Studies at the University of Utah, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our annual Lyceum II lecture in Environmental Humanities. I want to thank our gorgeous Salt Lake Public Library for hosting us this evening. I want to remind you, please, to turn off your cell phones, your pagers, any other weapons of mass destruction that you may have on your person. Also, no flash photography, please, tonight as well. Peter Matheson will be signing books afterward in the lobby, and they're available for purchase from Sam Weller's. The College of Humanities Program in Environmental Humanities is the first of its kind in the country, in which the importance of place, its divisive as well as its healing qualities, is studied in interdisciplinary contexts through the cultural, philosophical, historical, rhetorical, and literary lenses provided by the humanities. The program seeks to create an axis of inquiry around the integration of community and geography, focusing on the environments of culture, conflict, and resolution in the creation of a society to match our scenery. Past Lyceum II lecturers have been Terry Tempest Williams, W.S. Merwin, Wade Davis, Elizabeth Colbert, and Jane Goodall. Tonight we're honored to add Peter Matheson and Sabankar Banerjee to this prestigious list. Tonight also marks the first event in the year-long celebration of the centennial of Wallace Stegner's birth. Stegner told us in his Wilderness Letter, quote, "We simply need that wild country available to us, even if we never do more than drive to its edges and look in. For it can be a means of reassuring ourselves of our sanity as creatures, a part of the geography of hope." Tonight we're privileged to have with us two inspiring advocates of Stegner's geography of hope. Sabankar Banerjee uses photography to raise awareness about issues that threaten the health and well-being of our planet. Since late 2000, he has focused his efforts on indigenous human rights and land conservation issues in the Arctic, including an ongoing collaboration with Peter Matheson, some of the results of which have appeared in very poignant essays in the New York Review of Books. His photographic work has been instrumental in the ongoing conservation efforts of the ecologically and culturally significant areas of this often overlooked but essential region. His Arctic photographs have been exhibited in over 40 one-person and group exhibitions in the United States and Europe, and published in over 100 magazines and newspapers internationally. He's lectured extensively to educate the public about land conservation, resource wars, and cultural diversity issues. Senator Barbara Boxer used his photographs on the Senate floor in her attempt to block the Bush administration's plans to drill in Anwar and to counter its charges that the stunningly beautiful and environmentally crucial area was a, quote, white nothingness. Shortly thereafter, his exhibition at the Smithsonian was moved to the basement, with no signs directing visitors to it. So Sabankar is both famous and infamous. He has received many awards for his work, including an inaugural Greenleaf Artist Award from the United Nations Environmental Program and an inaugural Cultural Freedom Fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. Sabankar will be artist in residence at Dartmouth during the 2009 winter term, and during the fall he will be the Sea Change Artist Activist Resident of the Gaia Foundation. Since 2006, we are proud to count him as a visiting scholar in the College of Humanities Environmental Humanities program, and he is teaching for us now. Peter Matheson is a naturalist, novelist, Zen priest, legendary presence, and author of nearly 200 articles and essays, 24 short stories, and 8 novels. He was co-founder of the Paris Review in 1953. And in 1965, he published at Play in the Fields of the Lord about a group of fundamentalist American missionaries, a soldier of fortune, and their fanatical conflict over the fate of a South American jungle tribe. The novel was made into a major Hollywood film in 1991. In The Snow Leopard, winner of the National Book Award in 1979, he writes lyrically of seeking both endangered creatures in the Himalayas and of his own spiritual quest. tracking the nature within us as well as without. Blue Meridian, the search for the great white shark, presents his oceanic journey and documents the making of the film Blue Water, White Death. Many consider it the inspiration behind Peter Benchley's novel, Jaws. His crystalline prose in African Silences and End of the Earth recounts his treks through Africa and Antarctica, while The Birds of Heaven promotes the protection of the majestic cranes and the planet's ecosystem. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, kept out of circulation for 8 years by FBI-financed legal battles, it's a history of the desperate American Indian efforts to maintain their traditions and preserve the sacredness of the earth. His powerful trilogy, Killing Mr. Watson, Lost Man's River, and Bone by Bone, imaginatively reconstructs the life and times of the 19th century pioneer farmer and force of evil, Edgar J. Watson. It has been compared to the brothers Karamazov, Absalom Absalom, and Euripides, and it embraces the American experience from the Civil War to the Great Depression. In his newest novel, Shadow Country, Peter stunningly has reworked this epic trilogy, still offering new illumination about American self-transformation and renewal, patriotism and xenophobia, racial fear, greed, the rape of our wild places, and the psychological violence in the family. It is a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award, and many reviewers have written glowingly of it as a contemporary masterpiece. His recent writings about the endangered Arctic refuge offer penetrating insights into the effects of mining fossil fuels from a fragile landscape that will permanently endanger the indigenous peoples and animals of the area, deface and contaminate the region, and accomplish nothing to offset the oil crisis. There is no more powerful voice writing today. Please welcome Shubhankar Banerjee and Peter Matheson.
Thank you, Robert, as always, for that beautiful introduction. It's always a joy for me to come back to Salt Lake City, and to the large extent since 2004, it's because of Robert Newman and his wife, Vicki Newman. We have become great friends, and also friends, many friends now I have at the Environmental Humanities Program, Professor Steve Tatum, Mark Bergstrom, Heidi Camp, and many others. And this fall, I'm teaching for the first time a graduate level class, and I see many of my students here in the class, and tomorrow they'll have an opportunity to have a one-on-one visit with, or a group visit with Peter Matheson, which we are all looking forward to. Peter and I, it's always a great joy and a great honor to share the stage with the legend Peter Matheson, and I had the great honor to be with him in the Arctic on three separate visits, and he wrote three separate different essays on that. So later on, Peter will share a little bit about that. My first visit to Salt Lake City was in 2004, and we did an event about the Arctic and the Red Rock with our dear friends Terry Tempest Williams and David Sibley. And it's an event that I remember with great fondness. Since then, I've come back to Salt Lake City every year ever since and gave a lecture each year about the Arctic. So I thought, well, why don't I do something different? Because if I say the same thing, you'll be like, get rid of this guy. He keeps coming back every year and tell us the same old recycled stories. So I thought I'll do a little bit different, and this evening is truly to honor Peter Matheson. So I'll take a small amount of time and just mix and match a few different things, things that I haven't shared before. A little bit about some of my ideas about the aesthetic possibilities that has evolved over nearly 9 years now. A little bit about information, which I'll try to avoid because I've given a lot of information in the past in Salt Lake City. And a little bit about new work, which is in Siberia, because the whole project is an ongoing effort. And so it's a bit of a mix and match, but I'll take maximum of 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll welcome Peter Matheson. So let's see. So the first thing I'll do is, each time I come back, I tell stories about the Arctic, the contemporary situation, what's happening up there. I'll do a little bit of that tonight, but I wanted to little bit focus on thoughts, because I'm also teaching a class now, thoughts and ideas on aesthetics and how it influences how we think about this whole part of our planet. So that's what I'll try to do at the beginning. In 2001, which was the first year I went to the Arctic, in 2000 I was in the subarctic of Hudson Bay, but in 2001, for the first time I was in the Alaskan Arctic, I spent about 7 months that year with my guide and friend Robert Thompson. At the end of the year when I came back, and during that year, I was basically pointing my lens at everything that I could possibly point my lens to. And end of the year, I had a revelation. I started realizing that the idea to document the Arctic is simply futile. It cannot be accomplished. It's simply not possible because it is too vast. It's a space, too vast a space. The biodiversity is too broad. And the indigenous community is too numerous. I had to simplify. So I realized, how do I simplify? So I had to simplify, so I started thinking about a few simple conceptual strategies that I could wrap my head around and slowly progress as I build, hopefully, an aesthetic vision of cultural and natural ecologies of the North. And the first motive, so I had to come up with a few simple motives, and I basically come up with three, and that's going to be the ongoing process. So the first one simply was color, and that's it, color, color only. So I wanted to present the Arctic with color, grays, blues, whites, greens, browns, and not just any color, but minimal color. And I was deeply influenced by both late abstract expressionism and minimalism. So the kind of questions I started asking, as you will see in some of the photographs now I'll share, is can I make a photograph simply with brown and blue? As simple as that. Those were the questions I started asking. And this was a political choice, very purely a political choice, because Arctic is around the world, in the public opinion and public perception, is thought as a place of simply land of snow and ice. So we think of the Arctic, you go ask somebody in India, what does the Arctic look like? They said, it looks white. And so that's the popular perception. Then comes the perception of pro-development politicians who, in the United States Congress, who variously describe the Arctic as flat, white nothingness or frozen wasteland of snow and ice. And then, very interestingly, my wife and I caught a program on 60 Minutes about Norwegian Arctic, totally apolitical program about some seed banks. And the very first sentence, and on 60 Minutes, very first sentence, they described the Arctic as a hostile wasteland, something a little bit worse than even the politicians in Washington, D.C. So I thought color would be a wonderful choice as a motif. So that was the first motif. The second two motifs dealt with cultural and natural ecologies. So in the natural ecologies, I had to come up with something. I realized the biodiversity is too vast, and as the project progressed, I realized I'm simply interested in only three things, and three things only: birds, caribou, and whales. And the choice was for a very specific reason, because I was interested in primarily the local, regional, and global interconnectedness. This was a political choice again, because Arctic is traditionally thought of as a place very far away, way out there, totally disconnected from our contemporary reality or our life. So we'll talk about three of those interconnections. The global interconnection is birds, and I didn't realize this, migrate to the Arctic from every land and ocean on the planet each spring, hundreds of millions, that go to the Arctic, nest, rear their young. And I had the great opportunity to spend time with two of the greatest birders in this country, Peter Matheson and David Sibley. And I know nothing about birding. I'm total novice about that. But I was very hooked onto these birds. So birds, through those migrations, in my mind, is an epic celebration of life on Earth that connects the Arctic to every land and every ocean and possibly every people on the planet and the land they inhabit. So that was the global interconnectedness. And then I realized the caribou and the whales migrate hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles, connecting up numerous indigenous communities during their migration through the subsistence harvest process and their cultural identities. So I realized these three connections is a wonderful way possibly to think about the Arctic. And then the third one was cultural ecology. In the cultural ecology, I basically focused on one simple thing, which was, and it continues to be that way, it just keeps haunting me, the idea of bent posture or hunched posture, you may call it. And the idea came from, I'll give you a little background on that, how that came about, is it was a political choice again. And the choice was this, that the hunched or the bent posture has mostly disappeared from our contemporary consciousness. Because we basically sit down most of the time. We sit in an auditorium to listen. We get up in the morning, we sit down, we drink our coffee, we get out, we sit in the car, we drive to work, we get to workplace, we sit down, we sit in a conference table, we come back home, we eat dinner at a dinner table, then we sit down again, watch some TV, then we go to sleep. So we sit down a lot. So the hunched posture is something we don't think about. And it is a posture of labor, something that has disappeared from at least our visual consciousness. So we'll talk about that as it relates to subsistence practices. And that comes from me, like I'm deeply influenced by two painters, one 18th century and one 19th century. The mid-19th century French painter Jean-François Millet, we studied his book in the class, and British painter John Constable. And I go back and forth between the far and the near, because both has specific implication, because Constable painted it towards the end of his life what he called 6 feet painting, the large paintings, which is the far, because he was imagining that this mode of existence will disappear. And Millet, on the other hand, painted the French peasant life in his native Barbizon, which was the close, the near. And I'll talk about both. So with that just gives us a little background. Then I'll quickly share a few sort of stories and few things about the Arctic. Then I'll just wrap up. And that'll be that. Let's see if I... And I'll probably be sharing something that I shared before. Just a quick thing. Oh, gee, I left my pointer, but that's okay. I know Natalie worked hard to get the pointer. And Peter will talk about this as well, because this particular map is, as you can see, from the New York Review of Books that accompanied Peter's article in 2006. So that's the Alaskan Arctic, and four big regions are the Arctic Refuge, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is adjacent to the Canadian Arctic in Old Crow. And then the central Alaskan Arctic up there is Tashapak Lake and the whole National Petroleum Reserve, Utqiaġvik Uplands. And then the two oceans, the blue areas on the top, Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea. Just sort of a geographic place consciousness, sort of what we are talking about. And Guichin and the caribou. The coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is the core calving area of this Porcupine River caribou herd. It is also the most debated public land in the United States history, whether to open up this land for oil and gas drilling or to preserve it has been raging in the US Congress for over 30 years. Numerous indigenous communities living within the range of the herd have depended on the caribou for subsistence food. The Guichin people, which Peter wrote about very passionately, of Alaska and the Northern Yukon and the Northwest Territories in the Canadian Arctic, live on or near the migratory route of this herd, have relied upon the caribou for many millennia for both food as well as their cultural and spiritual identity. I have been spending time with the Guichin people in multiple villages, both in Alaska and Canada, for the past 8 years. And in Arctic Village, where I just took these photographs in 2007, they call me the real Indian. The Gwich'in are caribou people. They call the calving ground of the Porcupine River caribou herd Itsigwatsan Gwandai Goodly. That means the sacred place where life begins. These are my friends, Charlie Sweeney, Jimmy John, Danny Gimmel, and Rocky John. To open up the caribou calving ground to oil and gas development is a human rights issue for the Gwich'in Nation. In addition to the perceived threat of oil development in their calving ground, this caribou herd has been severely impacted by climate change in recent years. The scientific community states that this herd has been impacted more than most of the 184 caribou herds in the entire circumpolar Arctic for various reasons. It's fairly large also. And the numbers have declined steadily at 3.5% per year since 1989, from nearly 180,000 animals in 2000 to 123,000. Now we believe that it's probably less than 100,000. Warmer, wetter autumn resulting in more frequent icing conditions, warmer, wetter winter resulting in deeper and denser snow, and the warmer spring resulting in more freeze-thaw days and faster spring melt are among the key negative climate change impacts on the caribou and their habitat. And this is not only in Alaska, but throughout the Arctic, including in Siberia. And I'll get into that in a little bit. Plenty Coup, the last great chief of the Crow Nation, said in late 19th century, actually more the middle to late part of the 19th century, "When the buffalo went away, the hearts of my people fell to the ground, and they could not lift them up again. After this, nothing happened." Jonathan Lear, professor of philosophy at University of Chicago, wrote a wonderful book called Radical Hope, Ethics in the Face of Cultural Devastation. And in that book, he talks about, basically the entire book focuses on that last sentence of Plenty Coup, "After this, nothing happened." And our dear friend and renowned Gwich'in activist Sarah James from Arctic Village, as we compare what was said by Plenty Coup to what Sarah James is saying, "We are the ones who have everything to lose. Maybe there are too few of us to matter. Maybe people think Indians are not important enough to consider in making their energy decisions. But it's my people who are threatened by this development. We are the caribou people. Caribou are not just what we eat, they are who we are. They are in our stories and songs and the whole way we see the world. Caribou are our life. Without caribou, we would not exist." As I mentioned, several hundred million birds come to the Arctic from every corner of the planet, including actually two species that go from India to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, as you can see in the map, yellow wagtail and blue throat, including other parts of the Southeast Asia. And they go there, they nest, they rear their young, and they got to get out of there before it starts snowing again. Very short window. They travel from every continent, a global celebration of epic scale that connects the Arctic to nearly every land and sea on the planet. The Arctic River deltas, that's the key, that's what I'm focusing on. And it's surrounding tundra, wetland, that's what I was talking about, blue and the brown. Can we make a photograph with just blue and the brown, or the brown and the white? So that's how the aesthetic comes from. The Arctic River deltas and the surrounding tundra, wetlands, coastal lagoons, barrier islands, and near offshore waters provide rich ecological habitat for numerous migratory bird species. The birds use these ecoregions for nesting, molting, staging, and feeding. Major Arctic river deltas usually lie atop vast amount of oil and gas reserves. The Lena River Delta in Siberia, the largest and the most important river delta in the entire Arctic, the Mackenzie River Delta in the Canadian Northwest Territory, and the Yukon, largest delta in Canada, the Canning Delta, the Hula-Hula-Okpilak Delta, that's the photographs, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge of Alaska are all known to have oil and gas deposits underneath. And they're also known to be the premier habitats for migratory birds. In addition to the potential threat of oil and gas in these delta areas, scientists are predicting that the climate change will have severe impact on the global bird population and species diversity. Important breeding and nesting areas are projected to decrease sharply as tree lines advances northward, encroaching on tundra. This is the tundra. And because the timing of bird arrival in the Arctic might no longer coincide with the availability of their insect food sources, at the same time, sea level rise will erode tundra extent from the north in many areas, further shrinking important habitat for many species. A little bit on the western Arctic, and that sort of the brown, earth color, reddish brown, is the Eutaw River upland, which Peter and I been to, actually twice. The Eutaw upland is the core calving area of the western Arctic caribou herd, the largest herd in Alaska. The herd ranges over, and I was talking about the connectivity, the local, regional, and the global connectivity. I can show you a map of the Guichin and the caribou. It connects the entire sort of the northeast of the Alaskan Arctic, the entire northern Yukon, as well as the Northwest Territories. So three different provinces this herd is migrating around. The Western Arctic, this map basically does more than any of my photographs can do, is as you can see, they calve with that yellow area calving ground, then they spread out a little bit, the green area on the summer, then sort of that orange area is their sort of the fall migration, and the blue is winter range. And I don't expect you to read anything there, but all these red dots are various indigenous villages that are spread throughout their migration route. And on the bottom right is their migration patterns, as you can see. So through their migrations, they're connecting up these communities locally and regionally in a very unique and beautiful manner. The herd ranges over 140,000 square miles area, and about 40 communities, including Inupiat, Yupik, and Athabascan, are located within the range of the herd. For these indigenous communities, the herd is both a vital link to their cultural heritage and a staple of their diet. The herd has suffered significant decline in recent years from a population estimate of 490,000, like I said, is the largest herd in Alaska, 490,000 in 2003 to about 377,000 in 2007. Scientists speculate that, which was just last year, speculate that one of the primary causes of this decline is climate change. In winter, instead of snow, it's raining, when it's supposed to be 40 below zero, 50 below zero. And then it rains, then it immediately freezes, turns into ice, and creates a hard crust on the tundra, and the animals have a hard time breaking through the ice and eat, and they die in very large number. Under the herd's calving ground lies the largest coal deposit of North America, an estimated 4 trillion tons of bituminous coal, about 10% of world's known coal reserves. While coal is heavy and difficult to transport, there has been past proposal and current proposal to develop this area for coal. We see tracks on coal seams, the last image. As you can see, all this funneling is tracks made by the caribou during their migration, etched on the coal bed. And some of these tracks may be a few years old, some of them 100 years old, some of them may be thousands of years old, deeply etched, sometimes also on the rocks. And I'm, as you can see from some of the previous images, I'm deeply interested in tracks, because tracks are like a living history. It's a documentation of a documentation. And in this case, you can see the tracks right on the surface, which also means any coal development here would be mountaintop removal. And those of you who are familiar with the Appalachian Mountains, where basically coal has been scooped out, and only from the air you can grasp a sense of what has been done. And these large areas creating craters to leave coal slurry, which is a highly toxic compound. And coal and oil are also two, strangely, and I talk about interconnectedness, I'll not bring up in this lecture, but I'll just briefly mention, is the Arctic, which we traditionally thought of as the pristine, cleanest part of the planet, has become host some of the most polluted people and animal on the planet. Breast milk of high Arctic women in Greenland and Canadian high north are scientifically regarded as hazardous waste because our toxins have been arriving there from every part of the planet. So let's just give you a sense of some of this fossil fuel development, because there are people who do say the coal that is out here can fuel US energy for 400 years. Oil and the geese. The Tashapuk Lake, the big lake, one of the largest inland lake in the Arctic, if not the largest, and all these other little lakes that you see, hundreds and thousands of them, various sizes, comprise one of the most important wetland complex and the goose molting habitats in the entire circumpolar north. The Tashapuk Lake wetlands provide habitat for molting geese from three nations, Mexico, Canada, and Siberia, and nesting birds from six continents. As many as 37,000 Pacific brant, up to 30% of all Pacific brant, gather each summer to molt north and east of the lake. These brants come from elsewhere on the north slope of Alaska, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which is more to the west and a little bit to the south, the western Canadian High Arctic, and Siberia. Numbers of greater white-punted geese molting at Tashapuk Lake are increasing and range as high as 35,000. These geese are part of the mid-continental population, wintering in Gulf coastal states of Mexico, thousands of Canada, and snow geese. Why is it not moving? Let's see, maybe I didn't. Canada and snow geese also gather and molt in this safety of this wetland complex. This photograph, like in a digital presentation you didn't get to see, is the prints are actually 8-9 feet wide. And you can see every little detail. Again, it's one of those color scheme. It's primarily a brown image. But what you see when you go up close, you see the white, which is the snow geese. You see the gray, which is the chicks of the snow geese. You see the black, which is the brant. And you see a little brant. And so it's like, it's a place where life is born and renewed. And Tashapuk Lake also holds an important and culturally significant caribou herd. Inupiat and the whales. When the wind blows in certain direction, it brings in the salt water from the ocean into the lagoon system. When it blows in the other direction, also, and this wind has become stronger and stronger and stronger. The storms in the Arctic are fierce now with climate change. It takes the fresh water out onto the ocean when it blows in the other direction. And then basically the salt and the fresh water mix. And then we see the beluga whales. United States government has made strong effort. How am I doing with time? Already over time? Robert? Okay. US government has made a strong effort. These are actually, we saw about 995, we counted because I fly with the biologist, 995 beluga whales with calves in this one little small area. US government has made a strong effort in the past few years to open up the entire Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea of the Alaskan Arctic to oil and gas development. Several leases have been sold in the Beaufort Sea, and leases were sold on the entire 33.8 million acres of the Chukchi Sea planning area in spring 2008. Inupiat communities all across the north slope of Alaska depend on marine mammals of the Chukchi and the Beaufort Seas, including bowhead and beluga whales, seals and walrus. These communities oppose offshore oil and gas, as the fears as development would seriously impact the whales and their migrations and subsequently the Inupiat culture. Kasigaluk Lagoon, which is right here, along the Chukchi Sea coast, is one of the most important lagoon systems in the circumpolar north. The lagoon, it's very unique. It's about 125 miles long, and five major rivers drain into the lagoon, creating a rich and unique ecological habitat for a host of species, including birds and seals and whales. And public nearly knows nothing about it. And the beluga whales are also known to calve along the Kasigaluk and the Umalik Lagoon just south of it. Inupiat people of Point Lay along the Kasigaluk Lagoon depend primarily on beluga whales for their subsistence food. An estimated 10,000 bowhead and over 60,000 beluga whales migrate through these northern seas. There is a beluga whale hunt. Peter and I were on the boat for 17 hours, and he wrote very poignantly, it's a very difficult subject to write, in the New York Review of Books. In the American Arctic, this is the situation. Still today, nearly 750,000 caribou still roam the tundra, and 10,000 bowheads and over 60,000 beluga whales migrate through the oceans. But as you can see from the red, is already what has been leases that have been sold. Basically, we are fragmenting the north, and we are doing the opposite in the lower 48. Now there is this whole ecological movement called creating ecological corridors, connecting up the Yellowstone to the Yukon and other initiatives. And in the Arctic, we are basically doing the reverse of it, fragmenting it very severely. Five more minutes or two? Okay, that's it. Very quickly, Siberia. Last November in the winter, I was in Siberia, two regions. Actually, it's all in one area called the Yakutia, the largest province in not only in Siberia, in the whole world. And the Yukaghir communities and the Even communities, it's technically the coldest inhabited place on Earth. In November when we were there, it was 65 below without wind chill. In January, it gets to 98 below. It's much colder than Alaska. This is with the Iveni reindeer herder people. And I'll quickly tell a story as these images are going by. I arrived at this camp 300 miles from, it's way, way more remote than anything you ever experience in Alaska. 300 miles from the nearest little community. And so it's 5 hours of van, then about more than a day on reindeer. So we are on reindeer sledge. Then we arrive at the camp and truly middle of nowhere. And the first thing, the host family, and we have a host family, we are camping out, talks about these Bollywood movies that they watch while back in town. And so immediately, and I was with Robert Thompson, my Inupiat friends, so immediately we are accepted as family rather than visitors. So she said, well, me and my mother-in-law, we watch Bollywood movies all the time. It's cold country. And as you can see, the reindeers. This is with the Yukaghir community. And this is a community I'm trying to raise awareness as much as I possibly can. They are the oldest and historically the largest, but today the most endangered indigenous community of Siberia. There are less than 1,500 Yukaghir people, and only 8 of them speak the language. And a very quick story, when I was at the school in this community of Nelemnoye, we did a little presentation, and the school gave us 3 books written on Yukaghir language that teach in the school. And I said, how many copies do you have? They said, well, we have total 3 copies, but we'll give you 1 copy. I said, what do you mean? What am I going to do with this? And they said, well, we want you to go out and tell about our people because our culture is seriously endangered. And they are. I mean, there is various things. So with that, I'll stop and welcome Peter Matheson. Peter?
Everybody. Thank you for coming. To say the formality, I want to thank Dean Freeman and Dr. Tatum and other people who've given me a wonderful welcome here. Genpo Roshi at the Zen Center here, whom I had lunch with today, who's an old friend, and his wonderful wife, Stephanie, who may be here even. I thought she might be. I'm very happy to be back in Salt Lake City. I've been here a number of times over a long career. I skied at Alta till my son ran me off the slopes, for good and all. And I came here a lot doing work with American Indian people. I'd be in and out of this town a lot. And I taught at the university, actually. I came to lecture at the English department here. So I'm happy to be back again. This town has changed a lot since I first came here. It would not have gone, almost gone, for President-elect Obama. A big, big, big shift. I wanted to talk a little bit to tie into what Sabonka was saying, this is all part of the Wallace Stegner program, kind of, another installment of it. I didn't know Wallace Stegner very well. I knew him a little bit, and I'm a good friend still of his son, Paige Stegner, who may have been here too. He was a wonderful man, and I wish I had known him better. But in any case, I'm very proud to be here in this ICM lectureship. Sabankar Banerjee, as you see, is a very remarkable young man. And he was a voice out of the blue. He just rang me up one time and he said, how would you like to go to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? And on a float trip down the Congokut River. Well, since I've been trying to get into the refuge for about 50 years, it was a very welcome invitation. I went to Point Bao way back in the 50s. I was doing a book called Wildlife in America, and I was traveling all over the Arctic. But you couldn't go into the refuge. There was no way in, there were no roads, there was no access of any kind, let alone any tourist facilities. And it was a very expensive operation to fly in then, and certainly nothing I could do. So this was a wonderful opportunity. And I went to Alaska, and we did do a terrific river trip down the Congokut, all kinds of grizzly bears and everything that you'd want to see. I'm a birder and a great admirer of, especially of the sandpipers and plovers, what I call the wind birds. From all over the earth were there. Fantastic opportunity, have great fun. It also is a great chance in talking about the political climate of the refuge and the attempts to take it over by the oil corporations for many, many years, all the way back to 1980. Ironically, it was the Exxon Valdez catastrophe that saved the refuge for a long while. They didn't rush to develop after that. It was such a mess. And of course, they have an oil breakdown and a spill about once a day. We don't hear about it much. But Sabankar gave me the opportunity to really let go on ExxonMobil and these other outlaw corporations who run our country and have been for 8 years, all the way up into the Oval Room. And so I was, in his book, I was able to let go and tell them what I think. And I'm still doing it. And all the work we've been doing together has offered more and more opportunity to whack away at them. And they're still at it, drill, baby, drill, which has got to be the most idiotic mantra I've ever heard. All these people know, and especially the energy guru in the governorship up there, she knows perfectly well there's no oil coming out of that for 8 or 9 years. It would be the first oil we would get. And all this stuff that we would, you know, cure our energy problems with this, absolutely nutty. But they know better. It's all a bunch. It's like saying the Arctic refuge is a blank spot. There's a piece of white paper. They hold up these sheets in Congress and stuff. Well, Sabankar was one of the ones who disproved that. Sabankar came up here in March. He probably didn't know any better at the time, but he came up in March. He was so eager to photograph wildlife up here in the wintertime. Now, our best wildlife photographers have more or less avoided the Arctic slope in the middle of winter. You know, it doesn't look. And he went out there, and his sidekick, Robert Thompson, who's a wonderful Inupiat Indian guy from Kaktovik up on the Arctic coast, and he said, my God, this guy, here's a kid from Calcutta. Tropic raised, you know. And he shamed Robert into going out with him for 30 days in March out there. And they sat at one point for 30 days in a little blind trying to get a polar bear sow coming out of the snow with the cubs. I mean, incredible. And in any case, he showed how much life there actually is in the Arctic refuge, which is still, you know, moving even in the Arctic winter. Incredible, and incredible shots. Those winter shots he has of water ouzels in the winter and muskox and the bears and everything, and certain birds, jar falcons and ptarmigan. It's a very exciting time there, and so a great deal of credit is due to him. And I like two things especially about this guy. One is not his hardihood, but the fact that he works so well with Native traditional American people. They really love him. And we've traveled around together and talked to them. And I've worked with those people for years and years and years. And they know a phony very well when they see one, and he's not one. You know, that's terrific. And also the fact that when I first knew Sabalkar, he really was pretty much, he was a photographer. He's a wildlife photographer. That's what he wanted to do. And having been exposed to the politics of the refuge and the Uttatak Plateau and all these things, he's become, of course, a conservationist, a very eloquent one, as you see, and all over the country. So he's grown and, you know, enlarged his whole perspective in a wonderful way and deserves a lot of credit for that. He's now a leading spokesman for conservation in this country, which is terrific, you know. He's described all these areas so well, I think I won't touch on that. I think I'm under the gun here as far as time goes. I've been told I only have 8 minutes or something, but so I will just try to briefly just mention a couple of things I do remember. In the Uttatak, we were walking up a river one day, and this guy who was sponsoring our expeditions and paying for everything, a very nice businessman from Seattle, he, in his spotting scope, he turned around and he said, "I've got a wolf here, you know." And I looked in the scope, and there was this absolutely beautiful white wolf. I'd never seen a white wolf before, pure white wolf. And she was laying on the river edge and in the sort of the drift, sedge and stuff. And you know, if you have dogs, and I'm sure most of you do, you know when a dog is lying like this, they are completely relaxed. That is the, I have a white lab that lies like that. And you can, that's when they're relaxed. This wolf, she just lay there, and you could tell she was a she right away. At a glance, you knew she was a she. I don't know what the sign is. She just was very delicate and elegant, and you know, men, yeah, you know. and Sabalkar, he'd seen everything else, even wolverines, which I had never seen. I was very jealous about that wolverine. He had never seen a wolf. So I, knowing that, I passed the word back, "Tell Sabalkar, we've got a wolf." And I heard from way back, I heard, "Wolf!" In that inimitable voice, you know. And of course, even the wolf straightened up when he heard that voice. But she didn't spook, and he came forward and had a look at her. And then she went back into the willows, and I thought, well, that's that. We are very lucky to see a wolf that way over a number of minutes, you know. Just then, a big male got up behind her, and he came out, and then she came back out again. And they stood there and looked at us, looked us over. They weren't bothered at all. And a widgeon, a ball-pate duck, skidded into a little slough right in front of them, and they tried to stalk it. It didn't go anywhere, and they kind of knew it wouldn't go anywhere, too, but they put up the duck. And then the male came toward us. He's making his way through these willows right toward us. He just wanted to see what the hell we were, you know, what's going on there. And she was a little warier. She went up on the bank and then came along, looked at us from another angle. But he came up to, well, I don't know, Sabalkar exaggerates a bit, but I think that, but he wasn't any further than the other end of the screen here. And he looked us over, and there the willows kind of got very sparse, and he didn't want to come out in the open. But there he was, beautiful big male. And then he went back up on the bench where she was, and he came down, and then he tried sniffing us from every angle. He just turned around and around. And he finally got, he didn't know what it was, but he didn't like the smell of it anyway. So he moved her off, and they went up this bank, and then they just lay down and watched us. I mean, to see wolves that way. And we suddenly all had the realization, these wolves have never seen human beings, ever. They didn't know what the heck we were, and that's why they were behaving like that. Even the Inupiat people, down on the coast, 80 miles away, and they don't go up that far to hunt. And these wolves are all like that. They're there like the other wolves up there. They're waiting for the caribou to come. That's the big feeding time all year. But they'd never seen us before, and that's the most thrilling thing when you see animals that way. I very rarely had that experience with big animals. As for the white whales, those beluga, you saw all those boats out there, and they just, you know, they corral those whales and they herd them up the coast. And then it's at the last minute, when they get to near their own village, they rush them through these inlets into a shallow lagoon where they can work them very well. And I want to say, it's, you know, offhand, it's a very, very shocking sight. you see 40 white whales, and they're slaughtered. That's a lot of mayhem. But these people do it so efficiently, and it's very strictly done the way they do it. And they do not shoot any of the whales until they've got a harpoon in them, so they don't get away. It's done very quickly, at high speed, fast, and it's over. It's amazingly well done, because I've seen whale hunts elsewhere in the Arctic, and not so well done. In fact, at the same time we were doing this, there was an article in National Geographic which showed Inupiat hunters up on Baffin Island, and they didn't have a system like that. They didn't have shallow lagoons. There was no way they could do this hunt. So they were just standing on the ice floe, blazing away at every narwhal and every beluga that came up, they would shoot. So they were wounding all these animals. They didn't recover one. And they probably killed 18 or 20. That, it wasn't their, in a way, it wasn't their fault because they didn't have the circumstance, but still, that has to be controlled, you know, that kind of thing. Anyhow, I'm supposed to talk and read about this huge book that I can hardly carry up here. It's only 900 pages. I don't think I'll get through the whole 900, but I'll try. This book also has an environmental background. I've been working in backcountry Florida really since I was 8 years old, birding down there, working for Audubon Magazine on various conservation projects. And I also work with American Indian people down there a lot, Miccosukee especially, in the Everglades and around there. And I had all of these interests. I wanted to do a novel that came out of that. I'm basically, I think, a novelist, not a nonfiction writer, but nonetheless, so I wanted to get back to fiction. I wanted to do this. And then I heard this story about this Mr. Watson. He's not, as Dean Freeman says, a force for evil. I don't quite see him that way. Not at all. He was a very, in fact, I'm sorry to say, he's got plenty of company right now in the corporate mentality. He was an entrepreneur of an early kind on the frontier, and he was very ruthless, it's perfectly true, very able, and very well liked by the people. But eventually they put 33 bullets in him. And these were not killers, these were fishermen, farmer guys. They were just so, terrified, I guess, in a way. And my challenge was, this man did, I think, it's hard to separate him from about 7 violent killings. Not because he was a serial killer or anything like that. It was because he was ruthless on one hand, and the other hand is he had a very serious drinking problem that led to violence. And when you see what his background was, you sort of understand it. My challenge was to make this man a human being, to see him. I want people to see him as a little boy. How did he get this way? How does it happen that a guy who is very talented, very smart, very amusing, very... And he had 3 wives, not all at once, one after the other, but they all died naturally. These 3 ladies loved him. His 7 children with these ladies loved him. And several other ladies whom he had children loved him too. He's a well-beloved man. And even the men who killed him, they admired him. And, you know, he said that he's a fantastic storyteller, and they admired his talents. So my challenge is, how does he get that way? So I'm going to do a few short readings. The first 2 are a little bit longer, but not very long, I hope. And the first one, originally these were 3 books. These were 1 book called Killing Mr. Watson. I brought it into the publisher, and it really stood almost as high as this podium, and they just went, what do we do with that, you know, kind of thing. And so we agreed to split it into 3 parts, which were called Killing Mr. Watson, Lost Man's River, and Bone by Bone. And it was published that way, and generally very good reviews. But it didn't satisfy me. I didn't like it split up like that. And I decided I would take a year to put it back together, you know, like Humpty Dumpty put him back on the wall, and rewrite it and cut it, and I did. I reshaped it, brought out certain characters, and so forth. And I put it back into 1. Much shorter book and quite different, I think. But I think I could go back and do it again because I'm so compulsive, but I'm not going to. This is the 3rd book the first book is told by the people in the community, the other men, his daughter, various odd people. comment on him, who he was, what they thought of him, how they reacted to him. The second book is told by his son Lucius, who adored his father, really wanted to find out who he was. How did he get this dreadful reputation as a monster and a multiple killer? And he didn't believe it. He was a good father, and he was actually, in terms, even by tradition. By the way, I speak of tradition and everything, but when I began this book, I knew nothing about him because there wasn't anything really known. My big research tool was gravestones. They were the only data I could trust because all the rest was myth and legend and whatever. County records, they helped a little bit. I talked to everybody over 95 years old in Southwest Florida, and they said, oh, we can't wait for the book. Well, none of them survived to see the book. It's sort of sad. And but I didn't have anything else to go on. The family didn't want any part of me. You can imagine, 1910, dad, granddad is blown away with 33 bullets. You don't talk about that. That's a family affair. And they certainly don't want to talk to writers. The writers have made nothing but exaggerations, but it's partly the family doing. It's partly their own fault. Gradually, though, as I was working on this, they began to come out of the woodwork. An old aunt up there and a sister. And I finally, before the smoke cleared, I was able to talk to two of the younger children and a number of grandchildren. They all wanted to talk to me. And it was very moving because they didn't know much. I was able to show most of them the first photographs of their father they'd ever seen. And he was really, put down in the world. And I am to this day a friend of the youngest daughter, who is the only survivor now. And she's a lady of about 96 or 97. And she invited me to her birthday party a couple of years ago. And I didn't stint, he doesn't come out too well. Not everybody would want this man for their grandfather, let alone their father. But she said, thank you so much. You gave me back my father. She didn't know, she just had this black cloud over her whole life of rumor and speculation. No facts were known. Anyway, all the books, they had him. He was confined to Southwest Florida and the Everglades and so forth. He was actually born in South Carolina of a very good family. They owned 16,000 acres on the Edisto River. They were a very distinguished family. His father was a Civil War veteran, was a bum, really. He turned out to be, and very abusive, and his wife and kids finally fled to Florida. That's how they got to Florida. But Ed Watson, his name, then he got in trouble in Florida pretty early on, fled to Oklahoma. There he was arrested and tried. He's the only man ever tried for the murder of Belle Starr, the outlaw woman. However, Belle Starr being Belle Starr, if you read about Belle Starr, she was not an attractive person and certainly not a popular one. And there are at least 12 or 15 people who would have been glad to have killed her, so it's rather confusing. But Watson, and they couldn't convict him on it either, and then he was sent to prison for something else, horse stealing, and he escaped from there, got back to Florida, and then he finally went to the Everglades region. But a great entrepreneur, a very gifted farmer, he bought a ship and learned how to sail a schooner in almost no time. People were dazzled by him. He was a very, very able man. He's a great friend of the governor. His daughter married the first National Bank president in Fort Myers. That they were distinguished people. This is how he began. This is in the Civil War. He's trying to take care of his mother and sister. His father's gone away to war, and he's working. He's only a little boy. He's working in the fields, and he's working for his great uncle, Tillman, and Elijah, two uncles who are this. And his only friend is a black kid on the plantation who's very hospitable to him in the village named Joseph. And Joseph is a slave, and Joseph runs away with another slave called Doc. When the war was nearly at an end and many slaves were escaping toward the north, a runaway was slain by overseer Zebediah Claxton on Tillman Watson's plantation at Clouds Creek. Clouds Creek is where the Watsons had their holdings. Word had passed the day before that Doc and Joseph were missing. At the racketing echo of shots from the creek bottoms, yelping in fear for Joseph, I dropped my hoe and lit out across the furrows toward the wood edge, trailing the moaning of the hounds down into swamp shadows and along wet black mud margins, dragged at by thorns and tentacles of old and evil trees. I saw Doc first, dull, stubborn Doc lashed to a tree. then the overseer whipping back his hounds, then two of my great uncles, tall and raw-boned on raw-boned black horses. Behind the boots and milling beasts, the heavy hoof stamp and bit jangle, a lump thing in earth-colored homespun sprawled awkwardly among the roots and ferns. The broken shoes, the legs hard twisted in the bloody pants, the queer gray thing sticking out askew from beneath the chest. How could that gray thing be the warm and limber hand that had offered nuts or berries, caught my mistossed balls, set young Mr. Edgar on his feet after a fall? All in a bunch, the fingers contracted like the toes of a stunned bird, closing on nothing. On long ago Sabbath mornings of those years before the war, I ran with the black children to our games in the bare earth yards back of the quarters, scattering dusty pigs and scraggy roosters. In cramped, fetid cabins, I was hugged with all the rest and fed molasses biscuits, fatback, hominy wild greens. And always, it seemed, the sweet voiced Joseph made the white child welcome. Yes, Joseph was guilty, and our laws were strict. Alive, he would be cruelly flogged by Overseer Claxton, just as Doc would be tomorrow. Yet in my fear, I wept for poor gentle Joseph and pitied myself too, in a loss much greater than I knew. At daybreak, Mr. Claxton, on the lookout, had seen a small smoke rising from a corner of the swamp and rode on down there with his shotgun and his dogs. The slaves had fled, obliging him to shoot and wound them both. So went his story. He was marching them home when this damned Joseph sagged down like a croaker stack and would not get up. Too bad it weren't the other, and seeing he was the one behind it, I told him, shut up, you damn moaning. Told him, stand that son bitch on his feet, I ain't go all day. Done my duty, Major, but it weren't no use. Major Tillman Watson and his brother sat their big horses chewing on the overseer's story. The dead boy's homespun was patched dark and stuck with dirt, and a faint piss stink mixed with hound smell and the sweet musk of horses. Wet itself, the overseer repeated to no one in particular. He was a small, close-faced man, as hard as wire. Uncle Elijah Jr. complained angrily about the waste of a perfectly good nigger, but his older brother, home from war, seemed more disturbed by Claxton's viciousness. Damn it, ZP, you telling us these boys was aiming to outrun them hounds of yours? Major Tillman was backing his big horse, reining his head away toward home. Close his eyes, damn it. He was utterly fed up. Well, lay him across your saddle then. You can damn well walk him in. I reckon he'll keep till morning, Claxton muttered, sullen. You have no business here, I was admonished by Uncle Elijah Jr., not because I was too young to witness bloody death, nor because night was coming on, but because I was certainly neglecting whichever shore I had abandoned without leave. Major Tillman, half turned in the saddle, frowned down on me in somber temper. You're not afraid out here all by yourself, boy? Yes, sir. I mean, no, sir. No, sir, the major grunted. You get on home so you don't go worrying your poor mama. Trailed by his brother, who would never be a horseman, the old soldier rode away through the dark trees. Walk him in, the overseer squawked, once the brothers were out of earshot. They want him that bad, let him send the niggers with a wagon. Ignoring the dead boy's staring eyes, he stepped across the body to strip the bonds from the wounded Doc, who yelped with every jerk of the rough hemp. He's hurt, I protested. Claxton glared as if seeing me for the first time. Hurt? What you know about it? What you want with niggers anyway? He climbed gracelessly onto his horse, cracked his hide whip and single file through the black trees, the two figures moved away along the moon-silvered water into enshrouding dusk. The black man pitched forward, the lumpish rider and lean hounds behind. In dread of swamps and labyrinths of dusk, of death, the shadow places, I called after the overseer, my voice gone shrill. You fixin' to leave him out here? Out in the dark swamp, all by himself, with the owls and varmints. That's what I meant. The man snorted because he dared not curse a Watson, even a Watson as young and poor as me.
Niggers will come fetch him or they won't. His voice came back. In the dusk, the forest gathered and drew close. I stood transfixed. In his great loneliness, the body lay in wait. I wanted to go close his eyes, but alone with a corpse at nightfall, I was too frightened. Already that shining face with its stopped blood had thickened like a mask, and bloodied humus crusted his smooth cheek. At last I ran and knelt by Joseph's side, tried to pull him straight, free his gray hand, fold the arms across the chest. The dead are heavy, as I learned that day, and balky too. He would not lie the way I wanted. I stared at him frantic, out of breath. The forehead drain resembled the cool and heavy skin of a huge toadstool. The brown eyes, wide in the alarm of dying, were dull glazed, dry. Trying to draw the eyelids down, my finger flinched. So startled was it by how delicate those lids were and how naturally they closed, as if he were drifting into sleep, but also by the hardness of the orbs beneath their petals. Who could have imagined that the human eye would be so hard? When one lid rose a little, slowly, in a kind of squint, I jumped and fled. The overseer saw that I was barefoot and in tears. He did not offer to swing me up behind. He said, "I always told him there's no such a thing as too much nigger spirit." Not knowing what such words might mean, I stared back at the lump that had been Joseph. It was ceding all shape and semblance in the dark, subsiding like humus among the roots and ferns. Z.P. Claxton, I knew, would be laid to rest in higher ground, in sunny grasses, in the light of heaven. The dead I had seen before, but not the killed. Cousin Selden, home from war, had confided that the corpse of a human slain in violence and left staring where it fell looked like something hurled down wide-eyed out of heaven, nothing at all like the prim cadaver of the beloved in sedate sleep, plugged, scrubbed, perfumed, and suited up in Sunday best for the great occasion, hands crossed pious on its breast. Those who touched their lips to the cool forehead in farewell held a breath so as not to know that faint odor of cold meat. Or so said Cousin Selden, who composed dark poetry and liked to speak in this peculiar manner. Not that a darkie had been my beloved, but Joseph had been kind to me. He had been kind, and I had no other friends. How I would miss him. I was still young and could not help my unmanly feelings. So that is a crude attempt to try to win sympathy for this guy before he gets into serious trouble. Watson grew up, runs away to the South, gets in trouble, has various adventures, flees to Oklahoma, as I mentioned, and comes back. And this is an account of when he comes back, when he comes to the Everglades for the first time. And he's looking for a property. He has enemies. He knows he's going to be followed. He's a fugitive in Oklahoma and in Florida by this time. And so he's looking over the Everglades. That's where all the people fetch up. It's just like a big sack at the bottom of the United States where all the bad actors piled in. Civil War deserters, you know, and then a lot of Indian people who are fugitives from Georgia, the Seminoles, Seminole, and the Miccosukee also, and a lot of black guys who were slaves fled down across the border, and they made common cause with the Indians, and they often had, they were mixed blood warriors, they were formidable, and the U.S. Army never licked them, they never were beaten. They were, a few of them still stayed there long after the Civil War. 3 miles inland from the open gulf between the islands and the mainland, Chokoloskee Bay was a broad, shallow flat almost 9 miles long and up to 2 miles wide. At low tide, it was so shallow that herons walked like Jesus on the pewter shine a half mile from shore, and all around looked like the end of nowhere, mud banks and islets gathered into walls of mangrove jungle with strange stilt roots growing in salt water and leaves which stay that leathery hard green all year around. For a man from the north, used to the hardwood seasons in their colors, this tide-flooded and inhospitable tangle that never changed was going to take a lot of getting used to. That professor at the World's Fair in Chicago in 93, who told the country it had no more frontiers, had sure as hell never heard about the Everglades. In all South Florida, there was no road nor even a rough track, only faint engine water trails across the swamps to the far hammocks. This southwest coast called the 10,000 Islands was like a giant jigsaw puzzle pulled apart, the pieces separated by wild rivers, lonesome bays, and estuaries, where lost creeks and alligator sloughs, tobacco-colored from the tannin, continued westward through the mangrove islands to the Gulf as brackish tidal rivers, swollen with rain and mud, carving broad channels. In all the 10,000 islands, Chatham Bend was the largest Indian mound after Chokoloskee, 40 acres of rich black soil disappearing under jungle because the squatter on there with his wife and daughter would not farm it. They were mostly plume bird hunters living along on grits and mullet. Like more than one island inhabitant, now this isn't Watson's voice, which the first part wasn't. This is Watson talking. Like more than one island inhabitant, Will Raymond Esquire was a fugitive and killer, glowering from wanted posters all the way from Tampa to Key West. He liked the Bend because it was surrounded by a million miles of mangrove, giving the lawmen no way to come at him except off the river. The boy, he's being guided by a young boy from Chokoloskee. The boy had heard about this mangy bastard and was scared to death. We drifted down around the bend, keeping our distance. There was a loose palmetto shack on there and smoke, but when I hailed, no answer came, only soft mullet slap and the whisper of the current and a scratchy wisp of birdsong from the clearing. The boy slid the skiff along under the bank, put me ashore. I told him to row out beyond gunshot range, but stay in sight as a warning to Will Raymond that there is a witness. Not till the skiff was safe away did I call out once or twice, then stick my head above the bank and have a look. Nothing moving, nothing in sight. I rose up slow, keeping my hands well out to the sides, and nervously wasted my best smile on a raggedy young girl who retreated back inside the rotted shack. All this while, Will Raymond had me covered. I could feel the iron of his weapon and its hungry muzzle, and my heart felt naked, my chest flimsy and pale beneath my shirt. But I was up there in one piece with my revolver up my sleeve, smiling hard and looking all around to enjoy the view. Hearing a hard and sudden cough like a choked dog, I turned to confront an ugly galoot who had stepped out from behind his shack. Unshaven, barefoot, in soiled rags and an old broken hat, he stunk like a dead animal on that river wind. Even after I presented my respects, his coon rifle remained trained on my stomach, his fingers switching on the trigger. I'd seen plenty of this scurvy breed in the backcountry, all the way from Oklahoma, east and south. Knife-mouthed, piney woods crackers, hollow-eyed under black hats, and lean-faced females with lank hair like horses, and sour-smelling babes in long, hard, stringy arms. Men go crazy every little while and shoot somebody. Seems Will had done that more than once in other parts, got a bad habit of it. With his red, puffy eyes like sores, Will Raymond looked rotted out by drink, but also steady as a stump, a very unsettling combination in a dangerous man. The muzzle of a shooting iron at point-blank range looks like a black hole leading straight to hell, but I did my best to keep on smiling. "Mr. Raymond," said I'm here today with an interesting business proposition. "Yes, sir," I said. "You're looking at a man ready and willing to pay hard cash for a quitclaim to a likely farm on the high ground. This place, for instance. $200, for instance." That was a lot of money in those days. Will Raymond wore a wild, unlimbered look, and his manners were not good. He never so much as introduced me to his females, who kept popping out their heads out of their hole like the prairie dogs back in Oklahoma. In fact, he made no response at all except to cough and spit in my direction whatever he dredged up from his racked lungs. However, that mention of cold cash had set him thinking. His squint narrowed. While estimating how much money he might be removed from my dead body, he was considering that boy out on the river who was doing his best to hold his skiff against the current. Will Raymond had reached a place in life where he had very little left to lose. He coughed again that same hard bark. "If you're looking for a farm at the ass end of hell, 70 miles by sea from the nearest market, and have a liking for the company of man-eating mosquitoes and non-foot rattlers and river sharks and panthers and crocodiles and every kind of creeping varmint ever thunk up by the Lord to bedevil his sinners, well then, this looks like your kind of a place." "Why, that's right, sir," I sang out cheerily. "No, sir, it sure ain't, because I'm on here first. And next time, sir, you go to trespassing without my say-so, sir, I will blow your head off. Any questions?"
"Not a one," said I in the same carefree tone. I signaled for my boat. While waiting, I ventured to look around a little more, thinking how much my Mandy might enjoy these two big red blossom poinsettias. "Yes, sir, fine day on the river. Makes a man feel good to be alive." He spat his phlegm again. "You got maybe 10 more seconds to feel alive, and mister, and after that you ain't gonna feel nothing." Under my coat, the .38 lay along my arm, set to drop into my hand. To drill this polecat in his tracks would have been a mercy to everyone concerned, especially his poor drag-ass females. Instead, I climbed into the skiff and headed downriver. What I needed more than anything right now was a reputation as an upright citizen. So I put aside my motto of good riddance to bad rubbish in favor of every dog must have its day. This dog had had his day at Chatham Bend, and mine would come next, or my name wasn't Jack Watson, which it wasn't. Will Raymond observed our skiff until we passed behind the trees on the river bend. His figure stood there black and still as a cypress snag out in the swamp, his old Confederate long rifle on his shoulder like the scythe of death. Out on the coast again, looking back, I noted with approval that the mouth of Chatham River, all broken up by mangrove clumps, would pass unseen by any vessel, even from a quarter mile offshore. While in Key West, I paid a call. No, they go to Key West then. While in Key West, I paid a call in the Monroe County Sheriff in regard to a certain notorious figure depicted on the wanted notice in the post office. The murderer, Will Raymond, I advised him, could be found right up the coast in Chatham River. The sheriff knew this very well and was sorry to be reminded of it. He sighed as he bit off his cigar. My report would oblige him to send out a posse when, like most lawmen, enjoying the modest graft of elected office, he much preferred to defer these thorny matters. Taking the chair the sheriff had not offered, I said I sure hated to cause trouble for Mr. Raymond, but as a law-abiding citizen, I knew my duty. Looking up for the first time, the sheriff said, sardonic, "That mean you won't be needing the reward?" Sheriff Knight and I understood each other right from the first, and our understanding was this: we did not like each other. But a few days later, a sheriff's posse laid off the river mouth until 3 a.m, then drifted upriver with the tide, as I'd advised them, and had 4 men ashore before they hollered to Will Raymond to come out with his hands up. Will yelled he'd be damned if he'd go peaceable, and whistled a bullet past their heads to prove it. But he was peaceable as he could be by the time the smoke cleared. They flung his carcass in the boat and offered his widow their respects, along with a kind invitation to accompany the deceased on a nice boat ride to Key West. And the widow said, "Well, thank you, boys. I don't mind if I do." On my next visit, when I went to the sheriff's office to offer my congratulations, I happened to mention the information which brought justice to the murderer, Will Raymond. Wincing, he slid open a drawer and forked over $250 in hard cash reward without a word. I never kept a penny of that money. I went straight over to Peg's boarding house on White Street and offered it to the widow Raymond as a consolation in her time of bereavement. By now the widow was looking a lot better, or at least a good deal cleaner. Perky, she said, "Mr. Stranger, this sure is my lucky day, and you sure are my savior. Bless your heart." She offered corn spirits and a simple repast and took me straight to bed out of pure gratitude and the milk of human kindness. Buttoning up, I mentioned the late Mr. Raymond's quitclaim, and she implored me to accept it with her compliments, declaring her sincere and fervent hope that she would never set eyes on that cursed place again. Altogether, a touching story with a happy ending.
I strode away to the docks with a lilting heart, confident at last that my path in life had made a turning in the right direction. So you can see he's grown up a little bit since the first boy there. I wanted to tie this back in to environmental things, so let me read two very short little things. This is about gator hunting, and this is also from Watson's point of view, but he takes his boy Lucius, who's the one who adores him and is the kind of the voice of the second book. He takes him gator hunting. In the winter dry season, when the fresh flow weakened, the gators returned upriver into the glades. In a real dry year, they would pile up in the few sloughs that still had water in them. Taking a skiff load of coarse salt in 160-pound sacks, I set up camp on a long piney ridge near the head of Lost Man's Slough. Tant and Erskine were with me, also Lucius, who came along as camp cook out of curiosity. Working ever deeper into the swamps, leaving a trail of gator pools turned muddy red, we clubbed and axed for 3 weeks without cease, then stayed up late slashing the soft flats off the bellies and rolling them in salt by firelight. Around our camps hung that purple smell of heaped raw carcass. When we came back through, that smell had turned to the stink of putrefaction, as if the earth had rolled over and died, as if the earth had rolled over and died. Lucius, thoughtful and subdued, lagged behind as the days passed and no longer nagged me to let him shoot the rifle. One day we came across a big boar gator, 14, 15 foot, in a little slough under a willow head. Having eaten or driven off the other gators, it did its best to scare us too, emerging slowly from the water, swinging its long head to run these two-legged intruders off its territory. By now we were low on ammunition and wasting no bullets. I jumped to one side and fetched the thing a solid axe blow to the nape. The brute thrashed back into the pool and kept on thrashing till it rolled and shuddered and finally lay still. I got my breath and mopped my brow, getting a whiff of my own acrid stink in the steaming heat. These big old dinosaurs take a lot of killing, don't they? I said to the son behind me, who protested when I started to move on. I had to explain that the belly flat on a gator of this size was knobbed and horny, not worth stripping. He gazed at me in that open way he had inherited from his mother, then waded into the red water and touched the head of the dying gator. Leaving his hand there, he said, "Well, then why kill it, Papa?" That turned me in my tracks. "Why kill it? That's a bull gator, boy." And as an afterthought, I said, "That's one big gator less to come downriver, take a dog or a child." This sounded like bluster to my son, because bluster is what it was. Still polite, he said, "Papa, we going to stay out in the glades till we kill them all?" We slogged on back to camp, where I told the others we were heading home. We all knew we had killed enough, but it took a 9-year-old to put a stop to it. In the loaded boats, the flats stacked up above the gunwales. Any more would have been dumped out to rot. At Everglade, we laid our loads along the dock to be checked and measured. We were tangle-haired, bearded, sun-cracked, filthy, our clothes caked, stiff, and dark with reptile blood. Folks stepped back when we went into the store. Lucius said they recoiled from all that death on us. He never went on a gator hunt again. That's gators. And here's the other short bit. The big industry down there was not gators, it was egrets, plume hunting. Plumes are worth more than their weight in gold, literally. So the hunters often killed each other to get a good egret, a hunting ground. And there was a lot of killing of egrets and Homo sapiens, I guess. But some of them were faintly bothered by it, by the slaughter that was taking place all over Florida. It was taking place all over the country, that's for sure. There just wasn't any idea of limits at back of the turn of the century. It was bad here, you know, the buffalo, you name it, passenger pigeons. But here it was the egrets. Plume hunters shoot early in breeding season or when egret plumes are coming out real good. When them nestlings get pin-feathered and squawking loud because they are always hungry, them parent birds lose the little sense God given. They're going to come in and tend their young no matter what. And a man using one of them new Flobert rifles that don't snap no louder than a twig can stand there under the trees in a big rookery and pick them birds off fast as he can reload. A broke-up rookery, that ain't a picture you want to think about too much. The pile of carcasses left behind when you strip the plumes and move on to the next place is just pitiful, and it's a piss-poor way to harvest, because there ain't no adults left to feed them young and protect them from the sun and rain, let alone the crows and buzzards that come sailing and flopping in, tear them to pieces. A real big rookery like that one the Frenchman worked up Tampa Bay had 400 or 500 acres of black mangrove, maybe 10 nests to a tree. Might take you 3-4 years to clean it out, but after that, them birds are gone for good. It's the dead silence after all the shooting that comes back today, though I never stuck around to hear it. I kind of remember it when I am dreaming. Them ghosty trees on dead white guano ground, the sun in silence and the dry stink, the squawking and flopping of their wings, and varmints hurrying in without no sound, coons, possums, biting and biting, and the ants flowing up all them white trees and their dark ribbons to eat at them young, them raw scrawny things that's backed up to the edge of the nest, gullets pulsing, and mouth open wide for the food and water that ain't never gonna come. Luckiest ones will perish before something finds them, because they so many young that the carrion birds just can't keep up. Damn vultures set hunched up on them dead limbs so stuffed and stupid they can't hardly fly. It suddenly occurs to me I've been reading nothing but morbid violence. There's a lot of funny stuff in the book too. But I'm afraid that's not why I wanted to end, but I'm afraid I've kind of run out of time. Let me just, I did have a remark I wanted to make in conclusion about the environment. I read Jane Goodall's wonderful talk that she gave here in April, and she spoke about Homo sapiens as an intelligent animal, and how is it possible that we lack the sense not to keep on destroying our own habitat. This is what this book is partly about. This is what Svanka is talking about. This is the work we're doing together. We all work at it. I know all these people. We work and work. We try to, and we all speak in public, and we all try not to be old gloom balls. But hey, folks, it doesn't really look very good. Global warming and the water. And why are we doing this? Why are we doing this to our children and grandchildren? This is what American Indian people don't understand about us. How can we do this? Now think ahead. How is it possible that people who are capable of great music and art and great thought and philosophy, and we systematically go on for money, it's really greed at the bottom of it, it's always money, we go on destroying. And don't those corporations' heads who afford themselves millions of dollars every year, don't they think about their kids? The thing is, they have so much money, they can send their kids to the last places where they can see birds, and where they can get fresh water, and so forth. But the world's running out of water, and there are millions and millions and millions of us, and I say us, because we're the same as them. We are human beings. It's really terrifying. I kind of have been, but I really am not now. I was very filled with hope last week by our American decision. It doesn't mean that Mr. Obama doesn't have the worst possible prospect for his job. He's got a terrifying job coming up. He's going to alienate everybody, every one of us at one point or another. It's terrifying, but he seems to be strong. He seems to look like he can manage it. And I just think what a national hangover we would have had if we'd woken up to Mr. McCain and Mrs. Palin. We would have thought, oh my God, we had this chance, a worldwide chance. I was in Africa this summer, and there were Obama signs on little village stands that sold 2 or 3 cigarettes and beads. Vote Obama, way up in the Ngorongoro crater in Tanzania. I mean, the world is, they were like that, and we've done it. There's no thing we could have done to restore the damage these people have done in the last 8 years. except this. It's absolutely thrilling. So it does give me hope. And I'll tell you one little thing and then I'll shut up for good. I used to work for Cesar Chavez, which didn't make me very popular in the West for a long, long time. But I did a book on Cesar, who I think is the greatest man I've ever met, without any question at all, and the bravest, too. And he was always coming from poverty, fighting every kind of thing, and his workers being gassed, pesticide, everything. Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, was doing his best to destroy him. His own Catholic Church was doing their best. He had the whole system against him. He went up against it with no education, no money, no nothing, except guts. He did not want to see his people treated that way, and he wouldn't. And that's what made him great. Gandhi was the same. They're very much alike that way. But Caesar said, he said, if everybody, if all of us would do something, even if you're restricted to home, even if you're in bed, even if whatever, you can always write your lighting company. You can always do something. There's nothing, none of us can't do something. And he said, if everybody would do something, however modest, however humble, we could turn this thing around in 6 months. And you know, he's absolutely right. So what's going to make us do it? Well, we got to do it, and do it quick. Thank you very much. We're going to have a little time to take a few questions and answers, not many, but
we have about 10 minutes for questions for either Shivanka or Peter, and I'll try to visualize a hand somewhere or other. I don't want to just visualize, I want to actually see one. Yes, all the way in the back. There's a microphone coming your way in the back.
Hi, this is a question for Peter. I'm wondering how your Zen practice has informed your work.
You have to translate. I came in on Delta Airlines last night and I lost my hearing at about 15,000 feet. And I haven't really got it back yet. I'm suing Delta, but what? The question is, how does my Zen practice inform my work? I don't know, in a way. I have two books that deal specifically with Buddhism and Zen practice, and the snow leopard being one and the nine-headed dragon river is the other. But other than that, I don't really see it. I wrote a novel called Far Tortuga, which may be my own favorite of them all, and there I consciously tried to pare everything away, to keep things very spare, very simple, to get back down to the essentials. I eliminated all he said, she said. I eliminated all similes, metaphors, everything. Just the thing itself, just the feelers of a cricket or a cockroach, rather, sticking out from beneath the cabin on this wood ship deck, just those little golden things. You don't need to say they look like radio antennae or anything like that. They're just two extraordinary, delicate, golden things in the air and the sunlight and the sea. And so I try to keep it just to that, very simple. In Zen there's a saying, water in a bowl, rice in a bowl, water in a pail. How do you like these common miracles? And in Zen if you stay in the moment, you're surrounded by common miracles at all times. It's just sparkling array of it. And to get back to that, simplicity in my life has made a big difference. I'm still a very complicated person. I've never succeeded in the simplicity that I long for. But my kids tell me that my character has improved in their lifetime. But as far as my work goes, I don't really know.
Can you mention your early literary influences?
My early literary influences. I read, like every young writer, I read omnivorously. I was in the library all the time. I read all these books. It was wonderful in the old days. You read books, and in the old days they had a sort of, people didn't care about marking books, their opinions, you know, as they went along. And the commonest mark was, I assume it was little old ladies, but I don't know, but it would say, "How true! How true!" they would check these books. Anyway, I read an awful lot of books. I always say that the two writers who I think influenced me the most were Dostoevsky and Joseph Conrad. I just love their way they went about things. But I cannot point to anything in my work that has an obvious influence of other writers. I just don't see it quite. And then my work is not, you know, Far Tortuga is a little bit experimental in approach, but the rest aren't. So there's nothing really unique about my stuff at all, but I don't see the influence. Maybe it's just because it's so ordinary. There's no detectable influence. But anyway, I loved all the great Russian writers particularly. I loved all the great 19th century writers. We have some wonderful writers today. My favorite really right now, I think the most brilliant writer working today in America is Don DeLillo, who's won a couple of National Book Awards. He's a brilliant, brilliant writer. But there are many others, really good, real good writers, and it's exciting to be around right now.
That's an interesting point, especially for the medium of photography, because the last 30 years or 20 years or so, we have wasted a lot of time talking about this is conceptual art and that is documentary art. And and what photography has gone away from is that photography tells good stories. Whether it's conceptual or documentary, it doesn't matter. It tells good story. And we are, whether it's like we look at Jeff Wall's work or Cindy Sherman or someone like Nan Golden, they're all telling good stories and they're good artists. So I don't see the difference, because I think every documentary photographer in my mind is a conceptual artist, and the reverse is true. It's just the extent they go about doing what they do. So, I would not call Henri Cartier-Bresson a conceptualist necessarily, because his practice was different. But mostly, I mean, people who do documentary work, they think about things before they do things. So, and it's not that something is thought out prior and they go execute it. It's a living experience that you kind of, like a writer does, that you write and then you revise and you revise and revise. And for me, the way, like I explained in very quickly in 10 minutes today probably, is constant evolution, constant, and I'm learning constantly and evolving. So that's sort of the, I don't make a distinction between the two.
One of your books that I love the most was In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. Can you just briefly talk about the Native American in this country today and how they're doing and surviving and hopefully prospering?
It's a very succinct question. can you talk about the Native Americans in this country today? In a just a little set of tones would be good.
Well, I hesitate to do that because I don't like speaking for Indian people. They speak very eloquently for themselves, and they're having, as they always have had, a very hard time. However, since you opened up to it, and I have a captive audience, I want to refer to, I wrote a book called, that the Dean referred to, called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. Some of you who followed that book, which is mainly about the American Indian Movement and a man named Leonard Peltier, who was the only one convicted for the killings of the agents on Pine Ridge back in 1975. And I've been working with Leonard over 30 years now, trying to get him help. I got into the Clinton White House with his lawyers saying, if he really wants a legacy, Mr. Clinton would give clemency to this man whose own judges think he should have clemency. They admit they never pin the murders on him, but he's the only one they have, and they're going to keep him there. And he's been in there 32 years, and he was a young man when he went in, and he had nothing but a positive record with his people. You know,
It's a great, great outrage. And Clinton, at the last minute, caved in, which was his habit, and gave the clemency to a man named Mark Rich, who was a felon, escaped from this country, whose wife paid them a big sum of money, and he got out. Leonard Peltier is still in prison. He's got a parole coming up next month. It should be a mandatory 30-year parole. He should be let out no matter what. But the FBI, if you can believe this, because there's hardly any FBIs around who are still alive, who are, this is a long time ago, but there's a thing called the Retired FBI Agents Association, and these were the contemporaries of the two young guys who were killed. Nobody liked that, those killings. The Indian people don't endorse them. The Indian people back Leonard entirely because they know who did it, and it wasn't him. But he's still in there, and he's a brave man. He never whines. I would be very grateful if some of you, if you keep your eye on the news, and if you any way you can do it with your own local politicians or anything, when this parole hearing comes up, if you can, lend your support to any local Leonard Peltier group. There's some, I know Judy, if she's here somewhere, where is she? I hope to talk to her after. She's works with Leonard, has in the past, and still is you know, involved in it. So please, if you can do that, that I would just wanted to say that, and thank you for hearing that out. It's got nothing to do with my regular talk, but it is important, and I speak about it wherever I can. Indian people in general are always hard put to get their fair share of anything, you know, and some are doing very well if they happen to have oil on the reservation or they have a casino or something like that. Some people are doing well, but most people aren't. They're still living hand to mouth. People are still on these reservations in the richest country that ever existed. A lot of people are still living in cars, in wrecked cars in the wintertime. That's where they store their food and everything like that. You go on the reservation and take a good look, you'll be ashamed. I mean, really ashamed that we could let people live like that. Not all, but many reservations are like that.
So how do you propose to change a corporate culture that's made its money murdering the Indians and raping the women and killing wildlife?
I didn't hear that.
The question is, how do you propose to change corporate culture and all its problems?
How do I propose to change? Well, I'm running for president. No. We cannot cure it overnight, but we can all try. And you know something? And even, you know, practically all the fights I've ever had, I wrote a whole book about lost struggles for Indian people here and there. All those fights, important fights, and we lost practically all of them. We won two of them, and the corporations just lay low for a few years, and they come back and take it over again. They're very, very patient. But nonetheless, stalling is good. Holding action is good. Meanwhile, other things can get done. Meanwhile, so it's not wasted time, even though we're losing the fight on global warming. What we're doing is pathetic, almost nothing. We're losing the fight even more urgent on water. Water is the big emergency worldwide. And here are these corporations, they're selling water. The idea for Indian people that we are selling water. Water is like the air. They're going to sell air. But sell, that's the point. Drill, baby, drill, you know. Oh, I don't want to get on my soapbox. I'll get off.